What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golliver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael the Pod Pina of Sports Illustrated. Michael, I think the weekend after the trade deadline was really dominated by a lot of buyout talk and, frankly, a lot of buyout backlash. We got an email from Casey, Michael. I'm going to spare you the entire details, but Casey wrote us a solid, 6,000 words taking the NBA's competitive balance landscape to task by virtue of these buyout situations where a team like the Brooklyn Nets can go out and grab LaMarcus Aldridge, a team like the Los Angeles Lakers can just pick up an Andre Drummond and drop them right into their pocket. It looks like the Milwaukee Bucks might be able to add Austin Rivers, which I think is actually kind of a sneaky addition that maybe should really be infuriating people, except Milwaukee's not that big market Brooklyn LA team that tends to get so much of the backlash in these conversations. But Casey's general premise was that smaller market teams should be livid and their fans should be livid because players tend to go to the larger markets in these situations. A lot of times the smaller market teams, whether it's a Cleveland in Drummond's case, a San Antonio in Aldridge's case, are kind of footing the bill for these buyout players. In other words, they're almost paying them to go away and gravy train onto a title contender. And I'm curious, when you look at the state of this developing buyout market here, which I think has accelerated over the last 5 years or so, do you view this as a critical problem for the league? If you were Adam Silver, would you be trying to rein this in? Because we are seeing some really big names, also including Blake Griffin, sort of exploit this loophole to give themselves a second chapter for their careers.
Yeah. I mean, I want to start just by saying that Howard Beck wrote a really good piece on SI.com kind of outlining why this is viewed as a humongous issue, particularly from the perspective of those small market teams where there is a disparity in the league. Everybody knows it. If you're a glamour market, you have an inborn advantage to building a consistent championship contender. That's just kind of how the league is. When I look at the buyout situation, I mean, it's obviously not perfect. It's not ideal. It's not even fair. But the way I kind of see it, I think there are some tweaks you can make to improve it, but there's two things. One, Blake Griffin and LaMarcus Aldridge are, you know, they both signed with the Nets. I don't think that either one will be on the floor in crunch time of a playoff game for that team. That's not to say that they can't help in the regular season and that they won't be in the rotation potentially in the playoffs. But, like, I think their names are a lot more impactful than their actual production. Like, they are not even close to as good, in all seriousness, as Bruce Brown or Joe Harris or Jeff Green or some other players on that team who have been more influential and part of their success all year. And then the other thing is, I look at a situation like Al Horford's in Oklahoma City, where he is not going to get bought out and he's just kind of going to sit on the sidelines for the rest of the season and I guess stay in shape. And there was a report over the weekend that his agency would work to get a trade done during the offseason. And because of the contract that he is under, it was very difficult to move him. And I don't think we expected him to get moved before the deadline. And that's a big reason why. But, like, I kind of see it as if the NBA is an entertainment product, don't we want the best players or the most recognizable players to be on the floor on a playoff team? Like, in the playoffs competing? Like, how is it good for... I understand that there are a lot of issues with the buyout system right now and how things are operating and how unfair it generally is. But, like, why is it good that Al Horford just, like, isn't going to play the rest of the season? And how is that fair to Al Horford? You know what I mean?
So you're saying basically it's better to have these guys gravy trading onto title teams rather than issuing a press release where Al Horford's like, don't worry, everyone, I'm still going to stay in shape and use the gym here in Oklahoma City, but I'm actually not going to be playing and you won't see me on the court again until October. And hopefully we can, like, you know, preemptively announce that we want to be traded, 4 months before free agency. No, there's strange situations abound. I see a couple different factors. First of all, the increase of salaries is playing a huge role here. You know, a lot of these guys that we're describing were on max or near max contracts that they signed either late in their 20s or right around when they turned 30. Those contracts clearly have the potential to just nosedive in value very quickly after that they were signed. And that puts the players in a tough spot. It puts their incumbent teams in a tough spot. And if you're losing games, those guys are doing nothing for you from a long-term standpoint. And so, of course, you're going to want to get off of it. But there's, you know, because they're guaranteed contracts, there's no easy way to do that. So I think that, you know, some of this was going to be inevitable when you have these increasing salaries that are more difficult to trade, and the numbers are getting so big that, you know, people don't necessarily have the ability to construct trades to bring somebody like that on. It's sort of the only way out. Now, when it comes to the equitable part of it that Casey was describing in his email, how some teams are getting screwed, you know, I look at it, you know, a situation like Aldridge, where he's giving back a chunk of his salary, like a pretty meaningful chunk, or Blake Griffin, who gave back, I think, $13 million to leave Detroit. Like, that's at least somewhere in the ballpark of equitable to the smaller market team, right? So even if the big market Nets are getting those guys on minimum deals, at least there was some sort of a give and take in the process so that there wasn't just a clear loser, you know, in terms of Detroit and San Antonio. This Andre Drummond situation, where basically the Cavaliers have to pay like 90-something percent of his salary and the Lakers are going to get him for the playoff push and, you know, pay him less than $1 million, that is where the outrage, I think, to me should be really more focused. Like, if you're upset at this problem, those are the situations that, you know, basically Cleveland's paying for the Lakers to have an extra center. That's pretty tough.
Real quick counterpoint, and we talked about this when it happened, but nobody put a gun to Cleveland's head and told them to trade for Andre Drummond. Right.
Oh, 100%. 100%. And I'm not necessarily saying that I'm outraged by this. I just think if you are going to be outraged by the buyout dynamics, it's when one team is getting somebody, getting a player on the minimum, and there's no financial give back whatsoever. And the reason why they can't drive a harder bargain in those negotiations, Cleveland, is because Drummond's agent or his agency could be like, look, if you don't do him this favor, you know, we're going to steer players away from you in the future. You're kind of persona non grata. And when you're a small market organization, you don't have the luxury to kind of get into those steering matches. Remember back to Phoenix with Ryan McDonough, big public blow up with Rich Paul over Eric Bledsoe, I believe, right? That did not go well for Phoenix over the next couple of years. That really wound up kind of leaving a mark, and that's tough. And you kind of can't shake that reputation. So, you know, in these situations, the players and their agents do hold a lot of power. Teams feel compelled to do right by those guys. And that's why you're seeing, you know, an organization like the Thunder get way out in front of this and say, hey, don't worry, we're Al's buddy. We're not shutting him down. We're trying to, you know, make sure he's healthy for the next chapter of his career, and we'll willingly, you know, try to move him in the future, and almost bending over backwards to do that, right? So it's kind of a goofy situation. I think your first point was correct. The impact that these players wind up making on the playoff chase is definitely overstated in the moment. There's going to be less excitement around the LaMarcus Aldridge Nets experiment in probably 2 weeks or maybe even 3 days after he takes the court for a couple times than there was right in that moment. I think people get a little bit too fixated with the clutch points graphics with all these guys' heads, you know, photoshopped together, and it seems like it's the 92 Dream Team, and that's just not really the case. But at the same time, when it comes to the finances part of it, Michael, I would like to see a little bit more equitable treatment of the incumbent team. Yes, they were in a situation, nobody forced them to offer those contracts in the first place, but things do change. We need to recognize that the size of these contracts are massive. They do impede the team's ability to get business deals. The players are absolutely getting a lot out of the buyout in terms of a fresh start and the chance to chase a title. And I think that, you know, if you could work in some way, as was suggested in Howard Beck's article, where maybe there's a cap on the amount of the buyout, right? So you only have to pay 80% of a player's salary. The new team has to pick up the rest. Or you could give some other sort of financial relief. Now, I don't believe in going to like compensatory draft picks or anything like that, which I think was brought up by, somebody in Howard's article. I think that's too much. But the idea that you could get some real financial savings from these situations if you're a smaller market team, I think that would be in the NBA's best interest to do that. Mm-hmm. Do you have some reason that we shouldn't do that?
No, I mean, I agree with your point about the draft picks. I think that that hurts the players that are trying to move around and have agency. And one idea that I did actually like that I wrote down before I finished reading Howard's article was this idea that maybe teams can have like a limited number of contracts that they're able to actually buy out, maybe like one every 3 years, every 2 or 3 years, something like that. I don't know if that would actually deter what we've seen and how it would balance things out. But I think that maybe that could chip away at the problem potentially. But like, I guess, you know, if LaMarcus Aldridge signed with the Miami Heat, do you think like anyone would care about this as an issue? Like,
I've been saying since December, the Nets are the greatest villains. They're in your backyard, and you should be hyping these guys up. Michael, I thought you were going to come on this show and say, LaMarcus Aldridge, he's been underrated for a decade. I wrote that article about him at the All-Star Weekend 5 years ago. This is the Brooklyn Nets takeover. The championship parade is coming. Like, I thought you were going to come on here with that energy. And instead, I guess maybe you're doing your buddy LaMarcus a favor by trying to tamp down the criticism and tell everybody, you know,
exactly right,
get off his back a little bit. No, your point is very well taken. As long as a talent is spread out among the buyout market, then there's going to be less complaints. I'll say this. I kind of like this stage of players' career when they do, you know, hop on to try to get a ring, to try to get the validation. I mean, LaMarcus has had a pretty frustrating career, right? He was in Portland. They couldn't get over the hump. Damian Lillard kind of took his team out from underneath him. He goes to San Antonio. He's going to be the heir to Tim Duncan. It doesn't work out. Kawhi Leonard bails on him. And he's looking at a situation where he's never really had major postseason success. You know, if he's the seventh best player on the Brooklyn Nets title team, is that major postseason success? I don't know, but I do think it would provide a nice you know, chapter to his career that he just hasn't had previously. Similar deal with Blake Griffin. So I don't get upset or harbor resentment when these guys go chase a title at that stage of their career. If they feel like it's ticking and they want to win at the highest level, I'm good with it. I was actually impressed by Andre Drummond's decision on the buyout because he's younger than these guys. He doesn't have the other buyout players. He doesn't have the injury issues. And he's trying to play for his next contract, right? I'm surprised somebody else wasn't able to offer him something better than that minimum from the Lakers to just come in and get his feet wet and see if he could fit into a situation and become a starting player. Now, he might be making the same calculation as a Montrezl Harrell, which is, look, if you play on the Lakers, everybody looks at you, everybody talks about you. That's going to only increase your free agency value when it comes to the summertime. But I also think that Drummond is prioritizing winning here over his own individual numbers, his own individual role, and you know, potentially his own individual finances when it comes to his next contract in a way that I wasn't totally sure that he would. I mean, it took Dwight Howard until he was well after 30 to reach that conclusion. So for Drummond to do it here on a short-term basis, I was actually kind of impressed. And I also wonder if in a weird way, Michael, the Lakers stars' injuries actually kind of play to their benefit, because when you're pitching Drummond, you could be like, bro, we need you right now. We're so injured. It's, you know, we're going to run all sorts of pick and rolls with you and Schroeder for the next month. Like, come out here to Los Angeles and eat. And then in reality, when you get to the finals, Drummond's going to be, you know, in mothballs, and Anthony Davis is going to be playing the five, and it's going to be a little bit of a different situation, right? Do you think that any of those things influenced Drummond's decision?
I thought Drummond's decision was super fascinating because, I mean, the Celtics were rumored to be in there. I didn't really get that one, to be honest. I guess he could help in some form or fashion.
Well, just a classic case for Horseshoe Ainge, you know. Close, but no cigar.
But, you know, the Knicks had like cap space, like they could have offered a lot more money, I believe, than any other team if they wanted to. And I might be getting the timing a little bit wrong here, but I know Mitch Robinson fractured his foot, and I don't know if that happened right. It was right around the same time, I think, that we learned that Drummond was going to sign with the Lakers. So I don't know if that impacted anything at all. But I'm sure the Knicks would have loved to have Drummond, and he could have actually had a role on a playoff team, which would be nice.
Yeah. What about Charlotte?
Sure. Yeah. that would be really kind of weird if he went to Charlotte, I think. I didn't even like consider them. That's certainly a team that is going to probably throw some money at him or take a look at him this offseason. Absolutely.
Right. I'm just looking at it from the standpoint of like Biombo. It's like, oh God, you know, I mean, why not give him a look? Like, just like you're saying with the Knicks. And so I do think he probably had some pretty interesting choices. Why do you think it was the Lakers in the end? Was it the same reasons that are angering all the emailers? The glitz, the glamour, the sunshine, the, you know, the LeBron effect of being in the playoffs, all that stuff?
I don't know. I guess on the surface that certainly is a factor, but I look at this situation and it kind of confuses me that the Lakers would be so like adamant to add someone like Andre Drummond. It is nothing to say, this is not a criticism of Andre Drummond as a player or a person at all, but you look at that locker room and Marc Gasol took a pay cut to go to the Lakers. Montrezl Harrell took quite a serious pay cut to go to the Lakers. Anthony Davis is their center when push comes to shove. So if you're Drummond, I just don't know what the expectation is in the playoffs. And you mentioned this, but like he might not play at all in the playoffs. And if he does, whose minutes is he taking? And is that player going to get a little bit upset?
Well,
with that.
Michael, remember the Lakers had those rotating boxes for their championship rings where like you would open the box and the ring would spin 360 to just really reinforce how cool it was? Maybe Drummond saw that and was like, who cares if I play? I got to get me one of those. I need one of those spinning ring boxes. That's the ultimate enticement. Here is something that our outraged emailer Casey said. He goes, there is a widespread perception that the NBA is rigged for big markets and that emotional investment in the local team is a sucker's game. The sense of inevitability and lack of parity prevents the creation of diehard fans in the middle of the country. So while they might tune in to watch the Nets versus Lakers play in the finals, they do so as extreme casuals. That's not healthy for the sport. And then he went on to say that this diehard may stop watching the NBA just like he plans on boycotting all the Nets postseason games this year. So, I mean, we have to do some real outreach to Casey to remind him that, you know, basketball is a beautiful sport and the NBA, you know, for all its flaws, is a great league and we enjoy covering
the best league.
Yeah. How would you counter what Casey's saying there? Because I wouldn't necessarily dispute a lot of what he's saying.
Well, I would say that the Utah Jazz have the best record in the NBA. I would say that the Milwaukee Bucks are a title contender. I would say
Denver Nuggets.
There are
Aaron Gordon.
Trailblazers.
Smart.
No, 100%.
Yeah, smart, well-run, smaller market teams still have a chance. I think that's a great counter. And I would also say, like, Milwaukee's been in the mix, right? If they add a guy like Austin Rivers and, you know, plug a hole in their rotation, and he might get some really important playoff minutes, I mean, that could wind
up. He's huge.
Yeah.
He's good. I've always been a fan of Austin Rivers, especially when he was in Houston. I thought that, you know, he's statistically one of the better ISO players in the league. He can hit a pull-up three.
And he can get hot, too. Like, you know, every once in a while, he can get hot. And they just needed extra depth at that spot, right? Like, if Dante DiVincenzo were to go down or something like that, like, it would get really dark really quick for them. And he's also used to playing with PJ Tucker and understanding, you know, how you play off lead ball handlers who are going to do most of the creating and everything else. So I thought that was a pretty nice move for them. That would be one of my counters. I would also go to the idea that if your team is set, if you have really good front office, you may not even need to play in the buyout market. Like, let me ask you, do you think the Jazz were like, oh no, we didn't get Andre Drummond in the buyout? Like, they're looking at their rotation saying, we're good. You know, we could pick up a Matt Thomas randomly from Toronto at the trade deadline, yeah, just get one more shooter, just an embarrassment of riches. But like, they didn't really need to plug those holes because things were set up pretty well. And so I would say maybe, Casey, take a deep breath. I would say that for sure. And don't leave the sport just because of the buyouts. It's not quite that serious.
They don't impact the championship. Like, historically, they like, honestly, can you name anyone who was a bio player who seriously was a factor in a playoff run?
I mean, yeah. Like, last year's, I think, most important one probably was Markieff Morris for the Lakers, right?
Sure.
And okay, so yeah. How important was he? Ninth most important player for the Lakers, right? So it's not that they're having zero impact, but it's probably negligible. But I do think that Casey's onto a slippery slope, which is as these kinds of contracts, you know, continue to escalate, you know, you could see a situation in the not too distant future where Washington is looking at buyout negotiations with Russell Westbrook, or, you know, Houston's looking at buyout negotiations with John Wall. And when those happen and those guys join some, you know, big market team, prestige organization, there's going to be a lot of outrage. But it is important to remember the current versions of the guys who are being bought out are not the star versions. And that was your original point, which I thought was an excellent one, Michael. So I'm going to put it to you this way. I need a ranking, just a real quick one sentence take. How much will LaMarcus Aldridge help the Nets win the title on a 1 to 10 scale, with 10 being starting in game 7 and dominating Anthony Davis, and one being he's just wearing dress clothes on the bench because they don't even need him because they got Nick Claxton, a future Hall of Famer. Where does he land on the 1 to 10 scale?
3.
Wow. Okay.
3 maybe? Yeah. I don't see it. I'm sorry.
I might be like a 4.5. But I also, you know, my heart of heart, I kind of want something good to happen for LaMarcus. I do feel like he's kind of gotten a bum shake throughout his career. Okay, 1 to 10 for Drummond. 1 being the Lakers just decide this wasn't really a good move at all. We're sticking with Marc Gasol because of his basketball IQ. We're sticking with Montrezl Harrell because of his energy. And, you know, he is getting DMPs throughout the playoffs. 10 being it's this new return of big physical Lakers bully ball, and Andre Drummond, LeBron, and Anthony Davis are out there as an all-star trio, just dominating the glass and bringing rebounding back, going all the way to the title. 1 to 10, where does Drummond fall?
Also a 3. I'm sorry. I actually think that the likelihood of him doing potential maybe damage is probably too strong of a word, but ruffling feathers in the locker room is higher than him impacting winning on the court, is kind of how I view that addition.
Wow. I would actually go 5 simply because of the Jokic matchup, and this could just be influenced too much by Dwight's shenanigans, but I do feel like they might be trying to encourage Andre Drummond to get into that kind of clown mode, right? Of just being like super annoying and bouncing around.
He really shouldn't do that. Like, he's not 35 years old yet. Like, settle down.
Well, that would be my strategy if I was the Lakers, because Jokic is going to be a matchup problem. I think he's better than he was in last year's Western Conference Finals. He's got a better roster. He's got more help. And the Lakers are coming in probably in that potential matchup without quite as much continuity and chemistry as they enjoyed last year. So I'm just saying they could be highly motivated to pull out all the stops in that one. So I could see him being very helpful there in a way that Marc Gasol and maybe Montrezl Harrell aren't quite as much. But past that, I'm with you. In a likely finals matchup with Brooklyn, Drummond's probably not helping too much. He could also help as a body against Embiid. You know, that could be another one if Philly made the finals. Where
have you ever watched Joel Embiid play Andre Drummond?
I'm imagining it's not going great. But here's the other thing that I'm imagining is that, you know, Montrezl Harrell just, you know, giving up 25 consecutive dunks, and so it's more about limiting the scope of the damage as opposed to like, hey Andre, go out there and lock down Joel. I'm sure that's going to go well.
No, I mean that's a really accurate point, but I think I'm just generally more down on these than you are. And we haven't even talked about Gorgui Dieng going to the San Antonio Spurs. Not a glamour market at all, but a team that could use some size, some space at the 5 when Jakob Poeltl's on the bench. You know, they're playing Drew Eubanks a ton, and he's okay, but if they want to I think they've upgraded at that position and kind of replaced Aldridge a little bit. So that's and just like generally kind of when I look at, like, I put myself in the shoes of players who are bought out and they look around the league, like, I guess wanting to play on a pretty good team would probably have more value to me personally than just sitting on the bench on a great team. I honestly like was stunned that Aldridge went to the Nets just from that perspective, because he would be a backup five, potentially starting five in Miami. And like, why? And Miami is a championship contender.
Well, they got to get above 500 first. I hear your point for sure. I think that, I mean, I'm surprised more people didn't go to Brooklyn. I mean, you remember me. I thought Drummond, Tucker, and Aldridge were all going to go team up in Brooklyn, and it was going to be this just like absolutely like cascading, gravy train. But I guess I'm somewhat glad that didn't happen, because people would have been even more outraged. But I think that, guys reach a certain point of their career. Aldridge has nothing left to prove on the court, right? And if he does find a moment in the playoffs here and there, I'm sure that he's looking at recent examples, like late career Andre Iguodala or, some of these other guys who are able to kind of just go out on a high note. And that's probably what he's seeking. And that's actually why I was surprised why Drummond chose the Lakers, because, there is some level of personal sacrifice, which I didn't know if he was prepared to make quite yet. Hey, Michael, let's shift gears to an arguably more intriguing race than the contenders kind of fighting over these, middling buyout candidates, in your view. What about the tank race that's starting to shape up? It's pretty, pretty interesting. All right. I wrote about this for my Washington Post newsletter this week. You guys can go to my Twitter bio, click the link, and subscribe there. It's free. It comes out every Monday. So obviously the Orlando Magic are in just full tank mode after trading away half their roster at the deadline, right? Obviously the Houston Rockets are tanking because they have no alternative. They've been pretty horrible all season long. Obviously, the Minnesota Timberwolves are motivated to keep their draft pick if they finish with one of the three worst records in the league. So they want to do everything they possibly can to get way down to the bottom of the standings to make sure they don't have to give that draft pick to Golden State as part of the D'Angelo Russell deal. But then you've also got Detroit, which really badly needs a franchise player. Jeremy Grant's not the guy. Killian Hayes was out almost all season long, their most recent lottery pick. They need a real franchise guy. And then you've also got lurking the Oklahoma City Thunder, who, as you mentioned, have told Al Horford he can just work out and not play. They've bought out Austin Rivers. They traded George Hill. And it seems like they might be verging towards shutting down Shai Gilgeous-Alexander due to plantar fasciitis, although it's not totally clear how long he will be out with that injury. But I'm sure they're going to take it very, very easy down the stretch. So we only have 7 weeks left in the regular season. All these teams are basically fully motivated to lose. Oklahoma City gets Houston's pick if it falls outside the top four. So if Oklahoma City can kind of pass Houston in the tank strategy, right? If they can lose more games at a faster rate, get below Houston in the standings, they could theoretically have the number one pick and the fifth pick in the upcoming draft, which would be like totally transformative for the Thunder and completely screw over the Houston Rockets, which would just be a wild scenario to have unfold here after the nightmare season that Houston's been enduring. So I'm curious, as I'm laying out these dynamics that are going into this tank race, who do you want to become the ultimate tanker? Who do you want to get that number one pick? Who are you hoping loses more games than everybody over the next 7 weeks? Is it a sympathy factor, Michael? Is it a kind of a glutton for punishment factor? I mean, what's motivating your viewpoint of the tank race?
So I think before we should get into the specific teams, we should outline how lottery reform has kind of changed this conversation a little bit. So even if you do tank aggressively, you can't get higher than a 14% chance of getting the number one overall pick. And even if you do have the worst record and a 14% chance, the second worst team also has a 14% chance. Then the third worst team also has a 14% chance. And you can't get higher than 52.1% on a top, guaranteeing yourself a top four selection, and the three worst teams in the league have that advantage. So when we talk about tanking, it's just a different conversation than it was 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago, where there were real advantages to getting to the absolute bottom. And now it's like, I can understand why certain teams would be hesitant to just kind of totally punt on and just like lose all respectability on the floor. So I just wanted to kind of throw that out there,
right?
Because I think that that is really important.
Yeah, and let me kind of clarify here. The motivation for these teams is not necessarily to try to have like a couple extra percentage of, you know, being the number one spot versus the number two spot. It's just that with those encumbered draft picks, like Minnesota needs to finish with one of the three worst records to maximize their shot at not dropping, right? Because it's kind of an all or nothing proposition for them. If they don't have one of the three worst records, their odds that they have to give that pick to Golden State are better, and that's a nightmare. They can't go after this horrible season where they have the worst record in the Western Conference almost the whole way, have all these injuries to Kat and D'Angelo Russell, turn around and have to give away the number four pick in the draft to Golden State because of a trade that they botched last year, right? They just can't have that happen. So they have to do everything in their power to have the odds play in their favor. And I would say a similar thing for Houston, by the way, because of that encumbered draft pick with Oklahoma City. They have to be one of the three worst teams to maximize their shot at keeping their pick. If you lose 20 straight games, have to deal with John Wall's contract, trade James Harden for Kelly Olynyk and seven draft picks 5 years from now, you better have a Cade Cunningham to show for it, right? Or maximize your shot at a Cade Cunningham. So that's why this year's race is a little bit different, and I don't think those flattened lottery odds are going to be enough to convince Minnesota and Houston, like, oh yeah, we should just try to win some games down the stretch because it doesn't really matter. Like, they have literally nothing else going on in their franchise.
No, I 100% agree with what you're saying. I guess it's just more like, no matter how bad you are, like, both those teams could literally lose the rest of their games by 20 points.
And they should.
And they probably will. And the bottom line is that it will basically be a coin flip.
I know.
Whether or not
so
they get
scary.
To keep their pick.
It's so scary, Michael. Can you imagine the stress levels going on that day, you know?
Yeah. So I guess going back to your original question.
Yeah, I'm basically saying, look, if you want to frozen envelope this thing, Michael, I'm going to put you in charge. Now, the NBA has let me into that draft lottery room before. I inspected the machine. I didn't see any foul play or any, you know, funny business. But if you were in charge of sort of, you know, directing the draft lottery to go the way you want it to go, how do you want it to play out?
I have a really weird answer for this question.
I was counting on it.
Good. I want the Washington Wizards to get the number one pick.
Oh, so you want them to get rewarded for not tanking all season long and just being bad?
Tanking in their own way.
Wait, so let me guess your logic. You want them to get the number one pick so they feel comfortable trading Beal and buying out Westbrook?
No, first of all, I don't know if that is necessarily like the route, right? Like, I'm intrigued by it because there are questions. Like, what you just said is certainly a likelihood, but you could tell me that the Washington Wizards will put the number one pick up for the highest bidder, and it wouldn't shock me. Like, if the Washington Wizards called the Timberwolves and were like, we'll give you the number one pick in the draft for Karl Anthony Towns, what happens? Like, I think that there are questions like that when a team like Washington that wants to win right now and is so devoted to Bradley Beal, I think that it's just like the ripple effects would just be humongous and so fascinating. And I like that is so that's why I would love for Washington to get the first overall pick. But there are a lot of other true contenders out there.
That's a pretty crazy pick, Michael. I mean, they seem like they're kind of stuck in between eras where, like, a number one pick would almost complicate things for them, right? And it would be interesting to see which way do they go. But it's, you know, it's a good problem to have. But at the same time, it's kind of so messy. Out of the five teams that I mentioned, I think it would be incredible if Oklahoma City got the number one pick so they could get Cade Cunningham from Oklahoma State, right? And by virtue of them jumping up in the draft order, they knock Houston down in the draft order and get Houston's pick. So now they're in a situation where they have two top five picks plus 30 plus future picks over the next 10 years, right? plus a franchise player in Shea, plus Lou Dort on the NBA's best contract, plus Al Horford, signed, sealed, and delivered, ready to be traded at a moment's notice, and Sam Presti being the one who gets to make the calls. It could turn into an absolute chaos, Michael, and they could assemble a team. It wouldn't rival the Durant, Harden, Westbrook young core, but that would be so many assets aggregated into one place that they could do some truly, truly crazy things. Like, they have enough picks, they could just buy out the entire top five if they have the first and fifth pick, right? I mean, they could do almost anything that they wanted in that situation. So I'm sort of rooting for the rise of a new, like the resurrection of a small market power with the Oklahoma City Thunder. Don't you think the hype would go around them so quickly in that scenario?
Well, Poku, Moses Brown, Shea, and Cade Cunningham is obviously better than KD, Harden, and Westbrook. Bite your tongue.
No, I mean, so print up the clutch points graphics. If they added Cade and they had a top five pick, they could get, like, you know, a lot of other good players in this class. It could be wild.
No, that would be pretty crazy. I mean, there is a possibility that Houston gets to keep that pick. Even if Oklahoma City were to jump up, that is technically possible, although not great if you're Houston. That's not what you want. I think that's certainly a fascinating scenario, and I wonder what it would do to you're kind of breaking my brain a little bit, because I'm like, would they then dangle Shea, or would they be committed to spending money on Shea? I mean, I wouldn't trade Shea for basically anyone if I was them,
I think it would
the
be
possibilities and the options are wild.
It would be Shea and the young gunners, man. He would be like the old veteran, you know, the veteran old head.
Like 23
yeah,
years old.
Yeah, 23 years old with a bunch of teenagers, and it would be wild. They have no bad contracts after they move Horford. They would be set up. It would be absolutely incredible. It would be like Oklahoma City University all over again, you know? It would be really, really wild to watch. Are any of these teams, are you kind of dreading them when the number one pick? I mean, I hate to use that phrase. Look, Orlando's had a pretty good track record with its number one picks, right?
Can I talk about Orlando for a second?
Please.
Because they were my next. Yeah. So Orlando, if Orlando were to get the number one pick with their own record, you know, they're 15-31 now, they're 2-8 in their last 10. They're terrible. They were to get the number one overall pick, and then for whatever reason, things just kind of weren't working out in Chicago, and Chicago drops to fifth or sixth or wherever, to where it would still convey to the Magic. Like, Orlando could really, like, be almost exactly what you're describing with OKC. Obviously not with the same cachet of future picks. But you have Jonathan Isaac, you'd have Cade Cunningham, or I think we got to say, like, Mobley right now is in the conversation for the first overall pick based on what he's doing at USC. I mean, he's ridiculous. So either one is like a franchise building block for years to come. And then they would have another top five, six pick in a draft that seems to potentially yield five or six franchise players. So, like, Orlando has been so terrible for so long. It would be really fun if all of a sudden they were like the scary young team up and coming in the Eastern Conference. I think that would be great.
Yeah, like I was trying to say, they have had some really interesting moments in their franchise where they nailed the number one pick and then enjoyed, like, you know, a 5-6-7 year run, whether it was Shaq, whether it was Dwight. They need that injection, don't they? I mean, I feel like it's been a pretty rough last half decade. You know, even their best players weren't exactly the most, you know, marketable and exciting, you know, type personalities. Where you plug in a franchise guy coming out of the pandemic, kind of reboot the whole thing, that could be great for them. Anyone you don't want to see it, get it, Michael. I mean, are you rooting against any of these teams? Are you rooting for catastrophe for some of these organizations falling down the lottery order here, you know, with still 7 weeks to play in a lost season for them?
I don't know. Like, I think it would be kind of maybe a little lame, honestly, if Minnesota got the number one pick. Like, I guess I want Minnesota to keep their pick because I just feel so bad for them. But first overall, I don't think you deserve that 2 years in a row, given some of the decisions that the front office made. And it reminds me of what happened with Cleveland when Cleveland was just getting the first overall pick over and over again and like wasting it. That would be not great. Speaking of Cleveland, I don't really want Cleveland to get the first overall pick either. Just not a fan of the Cleveland Cavalier organization.
Well, let me ask you, on your love of chaos, if Minnesota got the number one pick, would that make both Russell and Towns trade bait?
Well, Russell, like, it's just, it's not that interesting to me because, I mean, he's on this max contract and he's just not, I don't know, he's, it's, you know what it is. I mean, he's just not, like, that good.
Well, that's so, what I mean. Could it be more interesting for the Timberwolves where they're trying to talk themselves into this cat Russell? I mean, remember when Russell came off the plane with that camcorder? Where's that footage? Can we get some footage of Russell actually playing basketball? Can I get a camcorder footage of that? So that kind of seemed like it was maybe not the best plan from the start. But if you have Cade Cunningham and Anthony Edwards, all of a sudden, that's your new core. You're going younger. You're taking out all the expectations. Maybe you move Cat, you know, to a different situation, and you just say, sorry, you know, the D'Angelo thing, you just get out of it, sort of like Golden State got out of it, and you're bad for the next couple of years, but you've got two fresher faces without some of the baggage from previous years. Would that be better for them? But you're saying it's not worth it for the league as a whole to save the Timberwolves that way.
I don't know. I mean, I am guilty of literally 20 seconds ago positing a fake Karl-Anthony Towns trade, but I kind of feel like he's the most underrated player in the entire league right now. Like, he's really good, and when he's surrounded by competent players, the Timberwolves are not terrible. So maybe we should stop trying to move him off that from that organization. But I think Houston is another team where it's kind of like, ever since they made the Harden trade, I've kind of, it was like fait accompli for me that they would get the first overall pick.
Ooh.
I'm not a conspiracy theorist, even though longtime listeners know that I've had some crazy conspiracy theories that I brought up on this pod, but it just feels like Houston's going to get the top pick because, like, you can't be that, like, it's not good for the league when an organization is that bad for that long in a large market that had all these fans who were invested in a team that nearly won the championship, came so close. Like, you can't just lose all those people. So I do kind of feel like Houston's going to get it. That's what I'm expecting, even though the odds are, what is it? Whatever 100 minus 14 is, those are the, I'm so bad at math. Those are the odds for them not getting the first overall pick, but I just feel like they are. So, and I'm not too excited about it. But can I throw another team at you? I know I'm just like kind of rambling, but another team I think we should just mention that you have not already and that you did not include on your list of teams that are tanking is the Toronto Raptors. Because they're not that good this season, and their odds to get a top four pick are basically 1 in 3 right now, which is really wild. Maybe they bounce back. You know, there were rumors about their interest in Bradley Beal, and one of the reasons why they didn't want to move on from Kyle Lowry is they believe that they're a move away from being a contender next season. So if they were to get a high draft pick, I mean, I guess like they have an incentive, I should say, to get a high draft pick in this year's draft that they can then package with a Siakam or Ananobi or whoever to get a star. I think that that is also a really fascinating development potentially.
Well, that's why I wanted them to trade Lowry, and it will be really interesting to see how do they manage his minutes going forward, right? Because he's logged a lot for them, especially in key important situations, but they do have reason to want to go down instead of going up in these standings, right? Why are they motivated to get into the play-in round? I don't really get it. I would much rather have seen them kind of punt and tank down the stretch and, you know, play for some of those lottery odds. It would be crazy if they got a top pick, they were able to re-sign Gary Trent Jr. after that trade, and then now they're looking pretty darn loaded, you know, with under 26 talent. You know, kind of at almost every position. That would be pretty awesome. So I guess I'm kind of rooting for that, but I was also rooting for Lowry to get traded, and they just didn't pull it off. So I don't know exactly, you know, they're a team to watch I think, over the next month in terms of how do they want to play this thing. I mean, if I were them, I would think about shutting Lowry down.
Well, I think that, like, the reason why what you're outlining may not be possible is because we've already discussed the Houstons and the Minnesotas of the world that really need to lose, like, or they will lose their pick. So leaping up, trading Lowry for like a 5% increase in the probability of getting the first overall pick, or an 8% increase in getting a top four pick, I just don't know if that is worth it if you're the Raptors. Like, they're already really bad, at least record-wise. I have faith that they could turn it around. But I think keeping Lowry and re-signing him and then making some moves this summer is also a route to kind of get back into the title conversation. So I understand why, if that's what their line of thought is, why they did not want to get rid of Kyle Lowry.
No, I hear you for sure. Let's take some questions here, Michael, from the Open Floor Globe. They emailed us, openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. Thaddeus said the real winner of the trade deadline was wing contracts. At what point do you realize you almost can't overpay a wing who can defend at a high level and shoot threes? Harrison Barnes is the perfect example. He and Thaddeus points out that I was probably crushing the Clippers a couple of years ago when they gave that contract to Harrison Barnes. And he says 18 months after that deal, teams were falling all over themselves to put in offers. I believe one of you recently mentioned that he had a good contract and the Kings decided he was so valuable that they wanted to keep him and chase a 10 seed. And he goes, an even more ridiculous point to this argument, I'd say about half of the analysis of Malcolm Brogdon's four-year, $84 million contract to the Pacers was that the Bucks clearly couldn't match an overpay like that. Look how awful and short-sighted that looks now. Long story short, pay and keep your wings. Denver has Aaron Gordon for this year and next. He's probably going to want a big contract after that, and the NBA intelligentsia tends to react negatively to big numbers. But those reactions almost always look stupid in retrospect for two-way wings. So it's a good point by Thaddeus. I would just point out there's a big difference between having Harrison Barnes on the final 2 years of his contract than having that entire four-year contract or whatever it was when he originally signed. And kind of same thing for Brogdon. Like, if the guy is still performing, that's great. But there's a risk factor when you sign the original number that he may not. And you can get yourself into some tough situations if guys don't live up to that production in the first couple of years, where those last years, instead of looking reasonable, are just, you know, wind up being dead money. But I think his point is well taken. Among role players that are desirable for winning teams right now, you would way rather have a guy who's sort of a 3-4, can defend multiple positions and shoot the three-pointer, even if he's not this amazing playmaker for his teammates, and even if he's a little bit limited on offense, and even if he's not an all-defensive level player. You'd way rather have that archetype than like a combo scoring guard, or, you know, a defensive-minded center, or some of these other archetypes that maybe were more in vogue, say, 5 or 6 years ago, right? Like, remember when Jan Mahimi and those kinds of players were getting paid pretty big contracts in free agency? Like, that entire avenue of roster construction has completely dried up. There was a real rush on this particular archetype during this year's trade deadline, and I anticipate that going forward into free agency and beyond.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this player type is the most valuable, depending on, you know, what your goals are as an organization. If you're trying to win a championship, you absolutely need these types of players. And maybe that is, even if you're not a very good team, you should want them and pay them a lot. I don't think necessarily that, I don't know, like this point isn't very, it's a really thoughtful email from Thaddeus for sure. But I think that, I don't know, it's just like not that surprising that teams would want players like Harrison Barnes or Aaron Gordon.
But when you go back a couple years, when you first saw what Sacramento gave Harrison Barnes, my instant reaction was like, God, you know, what are they doing? Why are they paying him that much money? They're expecting too much from him. And, you know, maybe at that time, it looked worse because they didn't have some of the other pieces in place. Maybe they were hoping that, you know, Fox would step forward as that number one guy, because it was no small contract they gave him. He was coming off some tough situations in Dallas where it was just kind of not a lot of impact. And we got another email from a Kings fan named Peter who made the same point. It's like everybody's, you know, crushing Sacramento 2 years ago. Now they're coming back around and trying to just steal Barnes out of nowhere. So I do think that there has been kind of a shift or an enhancement in the in kind of the perception of these guys' value in particular.
Maybe. I mean, maybe I'm just looking at it from someone who, like, always thought these players were super valuable. And it's also kind of like we have this really broad umbrella with these, like, big wings who can guard up or down a position and shoot over 37% from the three-point line or whatever. Like, there's a difference in my eyes between Harrison Barnes and, say, Robert Covington, let's say someone like that, who someone who can, like Harrison Barnes was so valuable to a team like Boston because he could actually create for himself. He could put it on the deck. You could throw it to him in an isolation in the post. He could pound a mismatch. And he's just a little bit more of a physical defender, particularly on the ball. So I guess I don't even know how to kind of engage with this, because it's just kind of obvious that players who can shoot threes and who can defend and are versatile are super valuable, and championship contenders or teams that want to be championship contenders want those players. And usually they make more money than those teams can afford. So I know Boston came up quite a bit in both those emails, and it's like, well, Boston normally would not be able to get a player like Harrison Barnes or Aaron Gordon, but they had the trade exception, right? So yeah, I know I'm probably rambling on this topic, but 3-and-D wings, or 3-and we need a new nickname for what this player type of player is, but that type of player is super valuable, and I do think you can overpay, because
definitely possible to overpay. I mean, look back at like Otto Porter type situation, right, where he's smacking that same archetype. You feel like he's a lottery pick. You know, he's going to have a higher ceiling than some of these other players. You know, he was really intriguing defensively and had a knockdown shot there for a little while, but injuries intervene and now he's completely stuck and you're dumping him as a contract, right? And he's not going to get a big number this summer. I also think just one other point on this, these guys are rarer than we think. I think that's also part of it too. Like, if you're looking to this upcoming free agency class, like in terms of these types of wings, you have players like Norman Powell, you have a player like Gary Trent Jr., but those guys aren't, you know, big time plus defensive players by the metrics over the course of their career.
Enough.
Yeah. So you have a player like Alonzo Ball, who I think is probably going to get a gigantic contract. And that might be one guy to circle here to prove Thaddeus's point. I'm almost sure my natural inclination when Lonzo signs like a 4-year, $100 million contract this summer is to just be just beside myself. And that's crazy. That's way too much money. And Thaddeus's point is, wait 2 years and you're probably not going to feel the same way. And I think that's a pretty valuable point.
Well, I would say look at Sacramento. Like, if I'm arguing with, like, in a vacuum, Harrison Barnes's contract is okay, but has it helped Sacramento at all? Like, I don't think so, which is why they should have traded him. Like, so it depends on who signs Lonzo, how much money they give him, because at the end of the day, like, this is a league with a salary cap, and you can't just throw money around for specific skill sets if guys are limited in different ways that are really important. So
that's a great point. This hasn't been some amazing home run for Sacramento either, right? I mean, it's been two really ugly seasons. They're only in the mix this year because of the addition of the play-in round. Barnes did hit a phenomenal game winner the other night. I don't know if you saw that. And he's actually had basically a career year this season, or pretty close to it. So they're kind of getting their best case scenario. And it didn't surprise me that they held him at the deadline, because the standards there are so low in terms of never making the playoffs and everything else that it's like, hey, we're going to try to, you know, ride this momentum as long as it will go. You know, but at the same time, like, yeah, they paid him like a number two or number three guy on a winning team, and he really hasn't been that so far either. All right, well, thank you, Thaddeus, for getting us thinking on that. I do like to apply your lesson looking forward here, And I think your point is right on in terms of just where this upcoming free agency market is going. There aren't a ton of players who fit this profile. The guys who do are probably going to get inflated prices. There is almost guaranteed to be a backlash to those prices, and we should all be a little bit more thoughtful about it. I think you're making a good point. But we should also follow Michael's advice. Look at the team context of who is handing out those contracts, you know, because not every contract is the same. If you don't have the other pieces in place, you are pretty much just throwing away money. All right, let's wrap up with one question, and it comes in from Michael. He says, for most of the season, it seemed like the MVP was a two-man race between Joel Embiid and LeBron James, both of who are now out for extended periods with injuries. This opens the door for someone else, but the question is who? Giannis is having another monster season, but voter fatigue is real. Jokic is facing his best season to date, but likely won't get the Nuggets higher than the fourth in the West. And the same goes for Damian Lillard, with probably an even lower seed. And don't even get me started on James Harden, who is, it must be said, dominating and doing everything for the Nets without KD and often without Kyrie. It would be a travesty if someone who literally didn't show up, then mailed in a bunch of games and took a stick of dynamite to a locker room, would be honored with the league's top individual award. My question is, which of the flawed candidates gets your nod, assuming LeBron and Embiid are off the board? Michael, so do you believe Harden, who said, I believe this weekend, that he thinks he is the MVP, simple as that? Do you think it would be a travesty if he won? And how would you handicap the race as we're starting to head forward here after the trade deadline?
Yeah, I mean, I think my thoughts on Harden winning MVP have been stated many times. It would indeed be a travesty if someone forced their way off of a team and trashed all of their former teammates out the door in a press conference, and also did not play as hard as they could for the first 10 or so games of the season to win MVP. That's just me. I care about that stuff, I guess. He's basically crossed off the list for me, as well as he's been playing in Brooklyn. But we look at kind of the other names out there, and I think, you know, that there are three names that have been percolating, particularly since LeBron went down. Jokic, who Basketball Reference has an MVP tracker, and Jokic is at 52% right now, so... seems like he's in the driver's seat, I would say, and deservedly so.
I've got my own MVP tracker. He's at 96% right now for me. Now it's okay. it's based solely on my gut. I think he's got to be the leader in the clubhouse, Michael.
Oh, he's the leader, I would say, for sure. You just watch Nuggets games, and I mean, I don't know if you watched last night's blowout win against the Atlanta Hawks. It was, I think, Aaron Gordon's first game. Yeah, it was Aaron Gordon's first game. And the glee on Gordon's face whenever he like back cut and the ball just magically was in his lap and he could just jump up and dunk it. Like, man, like playing with Jokic seems like a lot of fun.
Jokic, playing with anything resembling a point guard too. I mean, that's the other part. Like, this is going to be a real, real upgrade for Aaron Gordon. I appreciated his press conference about, oh, the city of Denver is a gem. It's such a beautiful place. I mean, he was laying it on pretty thick, which I liked. But yeah, this is a second lease on life for him for sure. And it got off to a really good start. I mean, there's really no way around it. I do think that Gordon's arrival also helps boost Jokic's MVP candidacy, doesn't it? Because it should make them better in the short term. It should help them climb up a little bit in the standings. And that's the only thing missing for Jokic. The numbers are all there. The impact is there. The health has been there, knock on wood. And look, it's not the sexiest narrative, but he's the first center to be a serious candidate at this stage, if we're not counting Embiid, in basically more than a decade, you know, in terms of a kind of a big-bodied mm-hmm. center. And that's going to, you know, there are going to be some voters who are like, yeah, let's give it to a center. It's been way too long. I could see people going that direction.
No, I totally agree. The other two names I want to mention before I get into a thing about the standings is are Dame, of course, who was your preseason pick that I was very jealous of. And then I wrote a column about a month ago saying that Dame should be the MVP. And yeah, Dame is he should be on everyone's ballot. Like, if he's not on your five-man ballot, I don't know why you have a ballot, honestly. Like, he's just so tremendous. And then Giannis, for sure. And we've talked about voter fatigue over and over again, and he's just playing.
Should we be
basketball.
Fatigued of the voter fatigue argument? Should we double it back around and say, screw that argument, it was good for the first couple of months, but all the other candidates have gotten injured, now it's Giannis's by default? What do you think?
Like, I would vote for Giannis in 2 seconds over Harden. I don't really understand, like, the debate there.
So let me ask you, will you have Harden on your ballot at all, or is it that personal?
Well, first of all, it's not personal.
It feels personal. You called it a travesty, Michael.
It's a travesty. If he were to win, I think it would be a stain on the MVP awards history. Like, it just, it is what it is. Like, there's a reason why no one else has, like, forced their way out of town in dramatic fashion, gone somewhere else, played great, actually decided to try there, and then won the MVP. That's something that has never happened, because it shouldn't happen.
Well, I could imagine a scenario where I could get around it, right? If he was averaging like 40 points, 15 rebounds, and like he was just very clearly the best player in the league and it was kind of undeniable, then I would say, all right, we need to kind of swallow our feelings, just admit that the NBA is a weird business. He did what he had to do. You know, maybe if he did an apology interview as kind of an olive branch to everyone, sorry for the whole little baby thing, you know, I didn't really mean the honey buns. And, you know, he kind of tried to work it and massage it. I could see it developing, but he's been very good. I think he's actually been the most consistent player in the Eastern Conference this season, even above Giannis. I mean, I think it's really close, but I would still probably take Harden in that situation. He's been elevating his teammates just in excellent fashion. But I think it goes back to that word of value and the criteria around the MVP, and I actually agree with you. I have no problem at all having Harden starting on the All-Star game. In fact, I think it was a travesty that he didn't. But when you're talking about value for the whole season and what that word means, I do think some of these other, you know, characteristics come into it, and that should hold him back. I would still have him for sure in the top five, though. What about you?
I guess it depends on when LeBron comes back and when Embiid comes back for me. There is a chance maybe he would get in top five, but I don't know.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, if he's sixth because it's Dame, Giannis, Jokic, LeBron, and Embiid, that's not a travesty. I think that's okay. If you have him like at 11th and you don't even, you know, give him a look, that's where I get into it. Here's what I want to do to close this thing out, Michael. We need to help Jokic with his narrative building, right, in terms of why he should be the MVP, because there isn't that super-duper sexy storyline around Jokic this particular year, right? He's just been consistently excellent. He's incredibly unselfish. He's been in that small market team. He's made no desire of going to a big market team. Like, there's different threads you can kind of pull on. He makes all of his teammates better. Obviously, you know, he coming off of a nice Western Conference Finals appearance, he's established himself as the best center in the NBA, in my view. What are the narratives that, you know, people who are pro Jokic should try to drive home here over the next 2 months to convince voters? Like, you know, if you're getting one of these influencer packs, Michael, as an MVP voter, what do you want to see in that package that's going to convince you to go Jokic over LeBron or Jokic over Dame or Jokic over Giannis?
Well, I mean, it's pretty sad that anyone would need a narrative to vote for Jokic for MVP. It's just like watch him play basketball. It's not even like a chore to watch him. It's a delight. He's one of the most original and exciting players of our lifetime. And he's entering his prime, and it's glorious. So watch him play basketball would be number one for me.
So
and then,
your argument is basically do a super cut of all of his assists for the entire year. That's just like 2 hours long, and it's just dazzling assist after dazzling assist. And then just send out that link to all the voters and be like, look, we know you probably haven't really been putting in the work to watch Denver Nuggets games every single night. Here's all you need to know about it. And it's just, you know, Jokic's 500 best assists of the season.
In the bubble during the Western Conference Finals, I pitched an article to my editor at GQ being like, can I watch every Jokic assist from the bubble and then just rank like the top 10?
So
and I can't believe he said yes.
So you're going to send your link around to all the voters, and that's going to be it. It's just going to be an automatic MVP for Jokic.
Yeah, well, that, I mean, just watch the man play basketball. The other thing I would say, and it ties into kind of our listeners' email, is like the standings thing. It's just like, who cares, honestly? Like, if you are the fourth seed or the fifth
Michael,
seed, but you are
Michael.
Whoa, let me finish. If you are the fourth seed or the fifth seed, and you are two games back from the two seed or two games back from the three seed, like, what is the issue there? Like, I just, who cares? I can't get so invested where we need the MVP to be on the best team. That just, like, it's really dumb to me, especially this year where everything is so uncertain and weird, and players are in and out of lineups, and it's just like, it doesn't really fact. Like, do you want Rudy Gobert to be the MVP over Jokic or Dame? Just like, stop. I don't like it.
No, there's definitely a line there, but you know, winning is really important. We do need to value winning. Denver's been, you know, better than probably most people realize. 28-18, you know, winning basically 61% of their games. But there is a perception difference when you're not even starting the playoffs with home court advantage, right? Isn't that sort of where the line gets cut off for most people? I thought it was kind of uncomfortable when Westbrook got the MVP and his team was so far down in the standings, and you get them into the playoffs, and you saw his value shine through. He wasn't nearly as valuable, right?
No. But here's the thing. Westbrook won the MVP because he averaged a triple-double. That was it. Everyone knew that, and everyone also knew who was voting for him, that his team was going to get absolutely steamrolled in the first round. Does anyone who watches the NBA think that the Denver Nuggets are going to get steamrolled in the first round or maybe even the second round? Like, they're a very good basketball team. And just like, look at where they rank in net rating, where their offense is. I don't know. It's just it's really silly, particularly right now to me. And yeah, it's not like I'm arguing for Zion, which I will be doing after this season concludes for the next dozen years, probably, to win MVP. But like his team is really, really good, man, and very competitive on a nightly basis, and no one wants any part of him in the playoffs.
You're making a really good point. Look, if they have a great record at the five seed, that shouldn't be disqualifying. I don't know if it would be, especially if Embiid and LeBron stay out. You know, he's probably still going to be in the mix. If you drop further than five, I do think that gets pretty hard, and the history would say people will just find a reason to vote for somebody else. So maybe that's where I'm putting the cutoff, but they should be higher than that. I mean, to me, they should finish as a top four seed because of the Lakers situation right now, and they've got some nice momentum here recently. They got the jolt in their arm that we described earlier. I feel like that's going to help them carry the day. All right, Michael, very well argued. We have reached the end of another episode of Open Floor, though. Guys, you can find us on Apple Podcasts by searching for Open Floor. That's two words. When you find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy to help us spread the word. Michael's on Instagram and Twitter at Michael @VictorPina. I'm on Instagram at Ben.Golliver, on Twitter at Ben Golliver. All right, Michael, until later this week, well, we're going to double back on some questions about what do the new look Nets look like. Surely we're going to get our first look at some of these buyout guys and how they're fitting in, and a whole bunch of other good stuff that came in over the weekend. I will talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.